State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Mark Lassiter will represent the appellant and Mr. Matthew Witten will represent the state.
Thank you, Judge. It is with a heavy heart that I'm here today. I just learned yesterday that my brother in Spokane, Washington, got caught up in a river and he has yet to be found. It's been 3 days. I tell you this not to garner sympathy from me or my client. I tell you this because it's important for justices to understand all the circumstances from which a person speaks so that they may judge his credibility. In this particular instance, it is also important to understand what my client's circumstances were and what the circumstances surrounding his stop and detention were so that you can fairly and accurately judge what happened and the reasonableness of his actions. Who is the judge of what is reasonable? In most cases, it's the jury. You can go to the jury and say, this was reasonable, this is beyond a reasonable doubt, this is not beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury determines what has reason, what has basis. Voluntary encounters are an entirely different animal. They're unique. The reason they are unique is because a person has no recourse to go to the jury. When I lost the motion to suppress based on voluntary encounter, I don't get to go to the jury and say, a reasonable person in his shoes would not have felt free to leave. And the reason is because questions of fact are the circumstances surrounding the stop. Rarely ever are those circumstances in question. It is the question of law of whether or not a reasonable person would have felt free to leave that allows a person to do a 3823 instruction to the jury. In this case, I could not appeal to the jury and let them know that this was not reasonable. My only recourse in this instance was to you justices. And that is the reason that we decided not to go to trial in the case and the reason that we are here today. I want to address voluntary encounter first because that is the main issue of the case, it appears to be, because all issues, if the voluntary encounter is reasonable, are moot. Community caretaking and reasonable suspicion for the stop. So with that, we look at voluntary encounter. So we need to know what are the circumstances surrounding this particular stop. And voluntary encounter, the goal is to discover what kind of message was conveyed to the citizen and considering the totality of the circumstances surrounding it. So to look at this, you need to understand what was going on. All of this is in the brief. However, it's important for me to just briefly go over it. Imagine yourselves, justices, because that's what we have to do. If you are the judge of what is and what is not reasonable, then you have to put yourselves in the shoes of my client. So you are sitting in an empty parking lot late at night. You have 1 foot out the door, your left blinker is on. You decide that you want to leave the parking lot, but before doing so, a chance encounter, a police officer drives by, and that police officer thinks to himself, why is that person in an empty parking lot? I think I'm going to go and investigate. As you can see from the brief, that's what the officer said. I want to go and investigate. He didn't want to go in and see if there was something wrong. He wanted to investigate. But you're sitting in that car. You decide to leave the parking lot. You put your foot back in the door. You turn your turn signal off. You close the door. You begin to back out. As you begin to back out, a marked squad car comes up from behind you. Shine stops. Shines his spotlight directly in your face. What do you think a reasonable person would do in that situation? Would you turn and leave? Would you continue to drive away? Because if you did, a reasonable person would think that he might be chased down for evading arrest. Now that's what they want you to believe, that a reasonable person would just feel free to ignore. But that's not what you in that situation would do. Because any reasonable person in that situation did what my client did and pulled back into the parking space. Now at that point, when he stopped, he slipped his foot off the gas pedal, put on the brake pedal, and his head went forward and hit the steering wheel. At that point, the officer parks his car, turns on his in-car video to record the interaction.
Is there a DVD?
There is a DVD, Your Honor.
Is that one of the things that was lost?
evidently in the second hearing, I believe it was played, and that is one of the things that is not before you today, because in the second hearing, that was talked about. In the second hearing...
But the DVD, just because the record was lost, doesn't mean the evidence is necessarily lost. Does that DVD still exist?
That DVD still exists. I have a copy of it. And the in-car video, the dash cam, was turned on when the officer got out of his vehicle. So it was meant to record the conversation. Why would you record the conversation if you're just seeing what's going on? But he gets out of the car, parks behind it, and in such a way that my client would have had to go around his vehicle in order to back out again.
Which is contrary to the trial judge's findings of fact in this case.
Yes, Judge, it is.
And I read the hearing, the first motion to suppress hearing record, and I saw nothing in that first motion to suppress hearing concerning where the police officer parked his car.
That is correct, Justice, and the reason for that is because voluntary encounter was not an issue.
So the only thing that could support the trial judge's finding of fact would be the testimony from the second hearing.
The testimony from the second hearing, because the second hearing was conducted only for the specific purpose of determining whether or not there was a voluntary encounter. The trial court judge granted the motion for reconsideration for the second hearing for the limited purpose, and he would not let us go outside this purpose, of discovering whether or not a voluntary encounter took place. Because it was an issue raised in the brief of the state to support the first motion, but was never addressed throughout the testimony. As you can see in my brief, not once was it mentioned, not once was it argued by the state that this was a voluntary encounter. So when my client pulled back in and the officer stopped behind him and got out, some of the things that the courts have decided to look for are what type of shows of authority. That's the real crux of the question. How did they show their authority? Well, here you have a spotlight. And while not definitive in and of itself from the Court of Criminal Appeals in Garcia-Cantu, it is a fact to be considered. And in Crane Court of Criminal Appeals, they said when you combine a spotlight with an authoritative type of command, it makes it a detention. In this case, you have the spotlight, but you have more than that. Because this very court in Wiseman held that when you have a stationary vehicle and the spotlight is used, it is different than when a spotlight is used to create the show of authority that makes a person do something in response. In this case, my client was backing out. He was going to leave, and the officer's own testimony supports that. When he said, and this is on page 12 of the brief, like I said, when I pulled into the parking lot, I saw him backing out, and from the way that he came to a stop, I believe that if he hadn't seen me pull into the parking lot, he would have continued to drive on.
Well, didn't the trial judge make a finding of fact that he was backing out before the light was turned on?
The trial judge, I believe, made a finding of fact that the spotlight came on before he started backing out, which was an inaccuracy. But when he pulled back into the parking lot and when the officer got out, he displayed the show of authority. He had a uniform. He had a badge. He had a gun. He had a flashlight. He was in a marked patrol car. He vocalized his command by saying, "What are you doing here?" He did so in an authoritative tone of voice. Now, you don't have that information in front of you because that was at the second hearing. The reason we had the second hearing was to discuss all of these issues. The positioning of his squad car so it was obstructing the movement. The time of night, it was late at night. Nowhere else to go. You're in an empty parking lot. Why else would an officer approach you except to talk to you about something? Dark versus light area. Citizen testimony. In Crane, which is a Court of Criminal Appeals case, it asks, did the citizen comply with an officer request? Did he yield to a show of authority? In this case, from the records you have in front of you, you can clearly see, and by the officer's own testimony, he pulled back into the parking space in response to my spotlight. He used the spotlight to elicit a response. That is the command. Then when he gets out of the car, in full uniform and demands to know what is going on. It is a command to respond to me. I ask you, Judge, put yourselves in my client's shoes. You're sitting there. A spotlight's been shown behind you. A car is parked directly behind you so that you'd have to go around it. It's a marked squad car. Do you, when an officer walks up and says, what are you doing here? Are you going to feel free to say, I don't have to talk to you?
You keep arguing that the car was parked behind him where he couldn't go around it, which is contrary to the court's findings of fact. And there's absolutely nothing in the only record that exists before us that addresses that one way or the other.
That is.
So why, how can we reach a determination concerning this without that second record?
If you want to know how you can come to a determination on voluntary encounter without that second record, is because it is one of the elements that applies. Another thing that was discussed in that second hearing, and by the way, I'm the only person who was at that second hearing. He wasn't at the hearing. None of you were at the hearing. We discussed it in detail. That's why we have records, so that I can cite for you exactly why my client felt that car was parked to a degree behind him. It wasn't blocking him completely, but to a degree that he would have to go around. But it is simply one of the elements. Another one of the elements is officer testimony. If you look at Exhibit A in the brief, you will see that the officer had an ample opportunity to put why he approached my client. Why did he approach the citizen? He put an investigative stop. These officers are trained to write accurate reports. They are trained to write down exactly what happened based on what they did. This officer was not going to let my client leave. And it's a catch-22, because nobody in that situation is going to feel free to leave, because they're going to feel that they're going to get charged with evading arrest. Or, take for example, if my client leaves, does then my officer have reasonable suspicion to detain him because he has ignored a direct request of the officer? Because that's another thing that the officer argues, is that I had reasonable suspicion to detain, and that I had a community caretaking privilege to investigate the matter to see whether or not it's whether for the person's welfare. In any situation in which I have described to you, in these circumstances, and you are to consider the totality of them, no reasonable person is going to feel free to just ignore that request. And a second hearing was conducted, and probably one of the most telling factors is that a second hearing was conducted. Why would you have a second hearing if it was so clear from the first? The judge had the second hearing because voluntary encounter was not addressed by the state in the first, because it wasn't an issue. They came up with it after the fact, knowing that they had no community caretaking and no reasonable suspicion. And I'll go into community caretaking just very briefly, because the issue is so clear. In order to have community caretaking, you must be primarily motivated by the community caretaking privilege. You must be totally divorced from the detection or investigation of a crime. In this particular instance,
is that a subjective or an objective test?
That is an objective test. You must be. Well, I guess objective is subjective to the officer. What is the officer's subjective opinion as to why he's approaching? Now, in this particular case, I cite to it many times, the officer notes a variety of circumstances. He says, I was investigating any number of things, to include domestic violence, to include burglary. And in that same Exhibit A, notice what he put. Because in that Exhibit A, you will see that it has a specific spot. It says, welfare concern. Reason for stop. PC arrest title. Reasonable suspicion or welfare concern. He put investigative stop. That is the definitive proof that you need, that it is not totally divorced. The other part is, in order to have community caretaking, you must have distress. If you don't have distress, which is what the Court of Criminal Appeals decided, you must have distress. Every element of the four factors of the right test are designed to explain or elicit whether or not there was distress. When I asked the officer whether there was distress, he said no. I said, did you observe any distress whatsoever? No, I did not. You can't have community caretaking. They know it. That's why they argued voluntary encounter.
So community caretaking was not discussed in the second hearing?
To my knowledge, Judge, the trial court limited our discussions to whether or not it was a voluntary encounter. The last issue, oh, I believe I'm out of time.
All right,
Mr. Lassiter, we'll hear your final thoughts on
rebuttal.
Mr. Witten,
can I proceed? And please, the court, counsel, share my sympathy with counsel and his family, and I'm sure all our thoughts and prayers are with his family and his brother right now. Thank you for having us here at Texas Wesleyan. This morning, I want to focus, if I can, on three areas of importance, and I actually disagree with counsel that voluntary encounter is the most important thing. I think community caretaking issue is the most important thing to discuss this morning, and that's the first thing I want to discuss with three things.
So you're conceding that it was not a voluntary encounter.
Your Honor,
you didn't come up with it until the second hearing.
Your Honor, in my brief, I've argued in the alternative, if it did not fit within community caretaking, that this was a voluntary encounter. And I do believe that falls within voluntary encounter. I'd like to rebut a few things he says later, but I want to discuss community caretaking. First of all, Your Honor, Justice Gabriel, in the second set of findings, the trial court did make a conclusion that community caretaking did apply to this case. I wasn't at the second hearing, but I know it was discussed in the first hearing.
Is an investigative detention a community caretaking?
There is a distinction.
Well, then why did the officer write that down?
The officer clarified his testimony.
When did he clarify his report?
What the officer said, in he checked the box for investigatory stop rather than welfare, I think is what the box said. And in his testimony, he said, well, he basically said it was to expedite the paperwork more than anything else, because investigatory stop encompassed all of the things that he was thinking about. What he testified to, I think, is more important, and the trial judge made a credibility finding on this in the findings. I want to talk about community caretaking first, because if you read the appellant's brief and what he said here this morning, he's articulated an improper standard for application of community caretaking, because he would have this court hold that in order for the community caretaking exception to apply, the officer must have been completely, totally divorced.
Well, isn't it actually what the case law says? It has to be their primary motivation?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so you agree that is the proper way to look at it. Was it their primary motivation?
I do.
Okay, so I went back and read the testimony from the first hearing, and what the officers testified to was his initial thought.
Yes.
Those are his words. His initial thought was maybe there was something wrong with him, but that he was also investigating possible domestic disturbance and possible burglary and criminal trespass and all these other things. Do you see a difference between an initial thought and a primary motivation?
No, I don't.
Okay, let me give you just a real practical hypothetical.
Sure.
Let's say I walk outside and I see a Ferrari, and I love that car. I think it's the most beautiful car I've ever seen, and then my initial thought is, that's the most beautiful car I've ever seen. I'm going to buy that car. And then I look at my bank balance, and I realize that really my primary motivation in life is to provide for my family and pay my bills and be a responsible citizen. So my initial thought was really foolish and is not my primary motivation. Those aren't the same things, are they?
In that circumstance, no. In our circumstance, the totality of the record makes clear that his initial thought was his primary concern. Because if you think in it, and you asked a question earlier, is this a subjective or an objective standard? It is the objective standard of what a reasonable officer would think when driving up on this kind of circumstance. And what we have here is a situation where it was totally dark, deserted, all the businesses were closed. Really, nobody should have been there. And the turn signals are on, the door's open, and he's hanging out of the car. So the officer, any reasonable officer seeing that, is going to think, I ought to just drive in here and just check this out. And he testified that initially his thought was, I think there's some kind of distress going on here. And the test is not whether that's totally divorced from thinking, well, we have sometimes we have a domestic disturbance in a parking lot or anything. But if that's his initial thought and why he pulled in, that's a reasonable conclusion that he came to in this circumstance. Now, when he pulled in and the car moved abruptly and the appellant hit his head violently on the steering wheel, that furthers his reasonable conclusion that this man's in some kind of distress. And at that point, the officer has made a reasonable conclusion based on the totality of these circumstances. I know we have four non-exclusive factors we look at. That's really a totality test. But those things are satisfied in the officer's conclusion that this man, I think he said his concern might have been diabetic shock or something like that, was in trouble. The appellant is articulated an incorrect standard. That reasonable belief that there's a welfare concern does not have to be totally divorced.
But it has to be the primary motivation. And he also said he was motivated to see if there were any other, that's why he shined the spotlight. Were there any other people in the car? Did they pull in there and had this domestic squabble? Was, you know, there were businesses there. It could have been a burglary. It could have been a multitude of things. And I mean, I have to go back to, just because it's your initial thought doesn't necessarily mean it's your primary motivation. He didn't really distinguish, at least in the first hearing. Of course, we don't have the second hearing.
On the contrary, Your Honor, I think that we can tell a lot from what his initial thoughts were. We don't know why he's shown that spotlight. Now, part of our test for welfare concern is, well, is there anybody there to help him? He's shown this, he did testify that he was shown the spotlight just so he could see if there was anybody else there. I think that does tell us something about whether welfare concern was his primary motivation. I believe that this case falls squarely within that exception, and I want to urge the court to understand that the Officer Wickham's welfare concern does not have to be totally divorced from an investigatory purpose. A reasonable...
In most situations, there would almost always be some, in almost every welfare situation, there would also be a potential plausible investigative purpose as well, in almost every situation, wouldn't there?
Yes, Your Honor, and appellant has talked in his brief and this morning about the Wiseman case, where this court held that it may not have been a voluntary encounter, but in that case, this court held it was community caretaking. This court held that, and those facts are substantially similar. But you're right, in any circumstance where there's a welfare concern, an officer simply does not have all of the facts yet before he has made contact with the person. This officer and here did not have all the facts, but he did have a reasonable welfare concern here. And based on his testimony, it really does appear that it was his primary concern.
How can we determine the correctness of the trial court's ruling at the second hearing without a record?
I'm glad you asked that. With regard to the community caretaking exception, that is what this first hearing was all about. I think we all agree that the first hearing was about that. The second hearing, appellant asked for, you know, another hearing for voluntary encounter. So we have all the facts for community caretaking exception that were developed at the first hearing. The facts with regard to community caretaking are substantially similar between the first set of findings of fact that came out of that first hearing and the second set of findings of fact that came out of the second hearing. In other words, with regard to this community caretaking exception.
Are we going a long way around the barn here? My question was, how can we uphold or reverse the ruling of the second hearing without the record?
How can you reverse the ruling?
How can we determine the correctness of the ruling without the record? Which I suspect is why you're making your lead dog one of the two arguments you made at the first hearing, because the second hearing can't be supported without a record.
It's not the only reason why. The main reason why is I think it really does fit within the community caretaking exception. But
if the judge signed the findings of fact 2 days before the hearing actually occurred, maybe he was relying on the first hearing. You think?
Well, I believe, and I put a footnote in the brief about that.
And you rightfully and professionally conceded that that was an assumption.
But it is an assumption. You are correct, Your Honor.
So what do we do about that?
Well, the second set of findings were sites.
Why have a hearing?
Yeah.
What's the point?
Well, let's just say we got rid of the second set of findings altogether, and we just went off the first set of findings since we couldn't reverse of the second. Just assume that. I'm not going to concede that, but we'll assume that. Well, the first set of findings, especially with regard to the community caretaking exception, facts are the same, and this court could uphold based on that. Your Honors, I do want to move on because I want to tell you, this court can rely, I believe, on that second set of findings if it chooses to do that. The trial court made credibility findings with regard to Officer Wickham's testimony, and also made what amounted to a credibility finding with regard to appellant's testimony, saying that appellant's testimony, that he did not feel that his belief was not reasonable when he felt he could not leave the situation. The trial court made that finding. But appellant has taken many of the facts of this case and said, or what he says are the facts from the second hearing, saying, well, these don't match up. That second set of findings is inaccurate or incomplete. But he waived that. He waived that complaint. Under Freud, he had a duty to bring any errors that happened, that were perceived errors, with regard to the...
I thought you just told us a minute ago that the second findings and conclusions were identical to the first. Now you're complaining.
No, with regard to the community caretaking.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Exception
okay.
to that. Gotcha. But it was the appellant's duty when those findings were entered to object to them if they were incomplete or incorrect.
Freud is factually distinguishable from this case. Because in Freud, the state was trying to argue on appeal that the trial court's findings were too general and they should have been more specific, and so this court should remand the case to the trial court. And we found that, in fact, that laying behind the law, you can't do that, you got to give the trial court a chance. Have you read the Scheidemann case?
Yes.
Okay, Scheidemann builds on Freud, and I'm really familiar with that because I was the author in that opinion. And in that opinion, we said that we're not going to put more hoops in front of an appellant that they have to jump through. In this case, there's no complaint. The state did a fabulous job, and I've been there, I know, in writing the findings of fact and the conclusions of law that the court took time. You covered everything. We said in Scheidemann, you don't have to object again when there were no findings of fact and conclusions of law. You can bring that up for the first time on appeal. Isn't this the same thing? Why would he be required to object? Obviously, he disagrees with the findings of fact and conclusions of law. He's got a second hearing on a motion to suppress. There is no reason to put that hoop in front of him because this isn't anything that the trial court didn't already have a chance to cure.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think this is an extra hoop where there weren't any findings and you're not objecting. This is a situation where there have been findings, and there was a period of 9 months thereabouts that passed between the time these findings were entered. Then he filed a motion for continuance that said, I haven't seen the findings yet, I'm not sure whether I want to go to trial. Then he files a bunch of pretrial motions, still no mention of problems with the findings. Then, many months later, he pleads. And this whole time, there's no mention of problems with the findings when Scheidemann is factually distinguishable in the sense that we do have findings here.
Object to something that we all know he disagrees with. What he's appealing on is not that they're insufficient or incomplete like Freud, not that they don't exist at all like Scheidemann, but in fact the findings are wrong. That's what he's really appealing on, isn't it?
But the problem is that if the findings were wrong, he needed to bring them to the trial court's attention because the standard of review for upholding or reversing a trial court's ruling on a motion to suppress this court, in under normal circumstances, is required to defer to those findings of fact and give them great deference. So
do you have any
he
authority?
Runs a risk. I'm sorry.
Do you have any authority for that position? Do you have any authority that's factually the same as this case, that they had to object to those findings before they can raise an argument?
Your Honor, I would continue to argue that Freud is factually not factually distinguishable on any basis that would require us to distinguish it here, because there were findings made. Appellant did not object. I see that I'm out of time. State prays that the court would affirm the trial court and affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you.
By just walking us through what happened with regard to these hearings from a procedural standpoint, the first hearing, the trial court decided it's a voluntary encounter, but it was all community caretaking evidence?
No, Judge. This is what happens. We make a... we do a motion to suppress based on the community caretaking privilege and reasonable suspicion. Those are the two arguments addressed by the state. Those are the two arguments that I addressed in cross-examination, because that's what they addressed in direct examination. Then, after we finished with the hearing, the judge asked us to brief the issue. I briefed the issue based on community caretaking and reasonable suspicion, not once mentioning voluntary encounter. When I got the state's response back, because they filed theirs after I had filed mine, it said voluntary encounter, in the alternative, community caretaking, in the alternative, reasonable suspicion. I went back to the judge and I said, these don't make sense, because when he gave the findings, he said, I believe it was voluntary encounter, in the alternative, community
That's
caretaking.
That's what I mentioned. So you had community caretaking evidence, but voluntary encounter
right.
findings. Then you have a second hearing where you have voluntary encounter evidence, and then you have community caretaking findings.
You can understand my confusion. So when I went back to the judge, I was like, what is going on? What do you want me to do? And he goes, sounds like an issue for appeal counsel. So I said, okay. So I thought about trying the case. And in my research, I discovered that one of the things I wanted to try was the voluntary encounter 3823, which I discovered I would not be able to raise to a jury, even though I thought there's no way a jury's going to believe that this guy's free to leave. So I say, you have a money situation. You can either pay your money to try a case, which we don't have a whole lot of chance of winning if the evidence comes in, or you can pay your money for an appeal, because that's the issue I want to go in front of. So we chose the appeal. So all those pretrial motions were designed for trial. And the fact that they say that I have not raised an issue with the findings is just absurd, because what on earth is a motion for a new trial? It is saying that I don't agree with the judge's findings. And that's what we did. And the judge, by the way, when I gave it to him, didn't even read my motion for a new trial. He just denied it. In about 10 seconds. So in addressing the community caretaking, I want to go real quick, hit this hard. Nobody ever talks about, the state never talks about the Wright case, which is the seminal case in this, saying that community caretaking has narrow applicability. It is not something you just pull out of a hat and use when you got nothing else, which is what all the officers are trying to do nowadays. I'm actually speaking at a conference because it is becoming more and more prevalent that officers, when they don't have anything else, are just whipping this out like a gun. Well, I've got community caretaking and think something may have gone wrong. The exact language is, must be totally divorced. That is from Wright, the seminal case. That is from Caddy, the Supreme Court case, from which Wright got its, Texas now has a community caretaking exception. It must be totally divorced. And they have expounded on that to say primary motivation. Now, how do we determine a primary motivation? I don't want to use this as an example because it chokes me up a little bit. But when my mother texted me yesterday after I got stateside, I was overseas, and she said, we have to talk about your brother. When I called her, my first question was, is there something wrong? What can I do? You know, is my brother okay? If you look at the first question, if one of your children gets in a car wreck and an officer calls you and says, Justice Walker, your son or your daughter's been in a car wreck, is the first question is, who's at fault? Or is the first question is, are they okay? When I asked the officer, what was your first question when you approached? He said, what are you doing? He didn't ask, are you okay? He didn't ask, do you need help? He didn't ask, can I provide some assistance? The reason he didn't ask that is because he didn't think that. He was investigating burglary. Just from what he said, I was investigating for any number of things that could have been wrong. Welfare, breaking into a building, domestic violence. If for one moment he had said in any part of any hearing, My primary motivation was to investigate the welfare because I thought he was going into diabetic shock. Do you think that that might be in their brief in bold letters? At no point did he say, my primary motivation is this. He said, I had a number of different things. That's not what community caretaking is. It is you are going there to provide an assistance that nobody else can provide because there's nobody else around. And that's why when we ask, is there distress? My exact questions, did you observe any type of distress? Correct. I didn't observe any type of distress. Throughout the entire process, you never observed Mr. Hernandez in any type of distress, correct? Correct. You have to have distress to have the community caretaking privilege. It's as simple as that. Corbin defines that. That's why all the other factors are lending itself to decide whether or not there is distress. The only thing I can say after this is for to take the state's argument to its logical conclusion that you have to uphold the findings as accurate if we do not object to them. Why would you have appeals? Even in appeals where you have records, and in this case we don't, in appeals if you have records, the issues would be moot because you have to find the court's findings correct if they don't object to them. So to take his stance to the logical conclusion, there would be no need for you unless somebody objected to the findings. And since there's no rule saying you must object to the findings, I think Justice Gabriel said it best. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments here today. We also appreciate you traveling with us to Texas Wesleyan University. Mr. Lastro, the court extends its concern to you on your situation, and we will keep you and your brother in our thoughts. With that, your case is submitted. You are free to go about your business.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.